Rajan Sumedho is going to talk on the unborn.
There's nothing really to talk about, is there? Well, I think the title was chosen for me. But in Buddhism, and mostly what I know is from the Theravada school, so I'm speaking from that. Within the Pali scriptures is definitely this, you know, when you contemplate and use the Four Noble Truths as your kind of a paradigm for practice, then this, like the third and fourth noble truth, definitely the realization of Nibbana, or the unborn, or the unconditioned. And I find within the Theravada Buddhism itself, so much of what is taught now is very much a kind of emphasis on vipassana meditation, where the three characteristics of existence are given tremendous emphasis. So you get this anicca, dukkha, anatta, or the three characteristics common to all phenomena, which is it's impermanent, it's unsatisfactory, and it's not self. And so these are for reflection. These are pointing to, getting us to kind of look at this rather than to just adopt these three words and kind of project them onto experience. And so just noticing how some people take this and try to practice with it as a way of that we tend to believe there is no self, or that all conditioned phenomena is suffering, or that everything is impermanent, how we can hold to these particular concepts, and then we tend to interpret our experience through our belief in these concepts, rather than taking these concepts and reflecting on experience. And so this is just to emphasize that the way is through mindfulness and through intuitive attention and openness, rather than through grasping any concepts, ideas, doctrines, or positions. And because of this, then I see in many people who practice vipassana, they get stuck in kind of a state where they keep noting the impermanence of phenomena, but the actual cessation of it, the realization of it, the reality of cessation, tends to not be realized in any practical way. And so therefore, in America, a lot of the vipassana centers that have resorted to other things, like there's tremendous interest in the Tibetan Dzogchen, or in the Advaita Vedanta, or the Punjaji was this Advaita teacher who died a few years ago, but was very popular among the Vipassana practitioners, both in England and America, because of course their whole point is this realization of the unborn, or the deathless, or the ultimate, we can put it in terms of ultimate reality. And when you're talking, when you're using words about something that doesn't exist, you know, what happens? You know, it remains very abstract. So for us, the unborn can be just another abstraction of our mind. We kind of, what is it, you know, where is it? Is it really true? Is there such a thing as the deathless? And the more we try to analyze it or think about it in this way, you know, we're limiting ourselves very much to this conceptual mind that we have, the concepts, the conditions of the mind that we create. And so in terms of, say, Theravada, they emphasize one thing, that when you ordain as a monk, you say, for the realization of Nibbana, you're taking the monastic form for the realization of Nibbana. Well, what does that mean? Or to realize desirelessness, viraga, or cessation, nirodho, or sunyata, emptiness, or anatta, non-self. And of course, these are abstractions, words that point, but cannot define. So the realization, of course, then has to come through this intuition. This is what I keep emphasizing and encouraging now in the way I talk, because I see people tend to not have enough confidence or trust in their own experience of emptiness or non-self, because it's so easy to fall back into the questioning mode. What is this? What is it? I want to kind of objectify it in some way, or pin it down, or you know, turn it into some kind of mental object that can be verified, maybe scientifically, or proven that it is such. When we use the word exist, of course, this word itself conveys this sense of something that comes up and exists, and then it disappears, and then it no longer exists. So when years ago, when the God is dead fad came into being, I was at that time, I was just becoming a bhikkhu in Thailand, and Time magazine came out, I remember, with this cover, a very striking, kind of startling cover of saying God is dead, and that is rather a strong thing to say, and it certainly creates all kinds of emotional reactions. Some people don't really care. Other people, it's really attacking their belief, their basic belief in what they depend on, because if God is something created, something that arises and ceases, then of course that means that God can, if God is born, then God dies. And so if God is born, then God is, whether he's alive now or he's born again or he's dead now, I don't know. But taking the word God, of course, is another word that we take for granted, because it can be put in the category of the unborn, uncreated, or that even in Christian theology, and Christian mysticism, you know, the realization of God is through non-attachment, through letting go, rather than through finding somebody called God that comes in and goes in your life. And of course, in Christianity, they've given kind of anthropomorphic qualities to God, so this makes it too kind of personal, making it like a father figure, a patriarch, God the Father, and this gives it, then this creates a sense of personal relationship on one level. We can all relate to the idea of a father, and that of course is the cultural conditioning that we have. We can assume that God is some kind of heavenly father, some powerful figure. But still, in terms of the reality of this moment, it always keeps it in some kind of possibility, and some abstraction of the mind. We, where is it? Where is he? And then the feminist movement, why does God have to be he? Why can't God be she? And this is a valid question. You know, why do we have to define God as with gender? So in Buddhism, they don't have this problem because God has never been anthropomorphized. It's not given any kind of human qualities or any qualities whatsoever except the awakening to the reality of this moment. So then, when we just emphasize the characteristics of phenomena, of conditioned phenomena, then what happens? We the mind going from one thing to another, just like with thought. If you get lost in your thinking, you just one thought connects to another and it associates. So you proliferate with your thoughts. And then if you have using thought for some kind of, with logic or reason, then you confine your thought to, a logical process, but it has one thing connecting to another. Or if we just take an interest in just the conditions that exist right now in this room, you know, when I look at you, I can just see, well, it's Robert and Catherine and Rojana, Vivian. I go from one to the other. And yet, what is also present is the space between Catherine and Rojana. But it can be completely unnoticed because the interest lies in the conditions that exist because they're interesting. They have qualities that you can, that can interest or cause some kind of emotional reaction to in consciousness. So, say a being who has not awakened to the unborn, but is merely looking at life through the conditioned experiences that they have, then their experience of life is very dualistic. It's always in right or wrong, good and bad, or it's male or female, or it's black or white. These qualities become the deciding factors in our life. You know, if something's right, then we must do it. If it's something wrong, we mustn't. And there's the logic there of do good, refrain from doing evil. But then, in terms of an understanding of the way things are, we're caught in this death realm of the things that exist, that arise and cease, that come and go. So our lives are oftentimes fraught with suffering because we can't keep anything as a permanent possession. When you put your faith into somebody else, you want somebody else to be here for me all the time, then there's always this feeling of loss when they go away, even when they just leave for a while and come back. But then inevitably, the death moment, and then the sense of loss. And all we know is that what we were attached to, what we depended upon, is dead. And we have nothing to... what do we do now if our refuge is in another person or in an institution or in a way of thinking or a family life or political view or whatever? Because these things are always subject to change and birth and death. So the unawakened human being, what we call the bhutucana in Pali, is forever suffering because their lives are forever threatened by the things that influence their consciousness. They can't hold on to anything. They can't sustain anything. But they can sustain an illusion, maybe. That's why we want, sometimes our demands of life are just for stability, for something we can count on. Don't act too strange. Don't do something eccentric. Don't go funny. try to keep this illusion of that everything's all right and everything's going to be all right, and then in the afterlife, what will happen when we die? Well, we'll all go to heaven, and we'll just have a Lester Summer School up in heaven. We have all the time, yeah. But I think if we that could be quite boring after so many weeks. So the Buddha pointed to suffering as in the First Noble Truth, as there is this dukkha. Now, when you go to sometimes interfaith meetings, people find this rather depressing because, like theistic religions, tend to see this as some kind of positioning that we assume that life is suffering, or we put it on a broad spectrum of a belief system. We must believe that everything is dukkha, all is unsatisfactory, and then if we grasp that view, this misinterpretation of the First Noble Truth, then of course we tend to feel obliged to interpret everything in that way. So I remember in meeting people or monks who would feel that even looking at flowers was dangerous because after all they're going to wilt and die and all you do is get attached to them and then they fail you in the long run. So it's a kind of perpetual wet blanket that you're applying onto your own experience, which leads to depression. You know, you if you keep doing that, you just feel depressed and that there's no purpose or meaning to your life. So recognize that the Buddha took this most ordinary condition that we all have, that we all experience, not all the time, but the dukkha comes and goes. It's not a permanent state. But he's taking something that's quite common to all of us and putting it in the context of a noble truth rather than as a horrible fact or, you know, some kind of miserable statement about life as a pessimistic view. But notice the word noble is put into a position of nobility, of what they call the Arya Satya, or noble truth. Well, this is something to begin to... We're not told to grasp or believe this noble truth. It's not a belief. It's not a dogma. It's not a metaphysical truth. Is it? It's not talking about the ultimate reality, but it's pointing to a very common human experience of loss, of identity with that which is unsatisfactory and changing, with the delusions that we create and the expectations and assumptions that we make in regards to our lives. And in the in Buddhism also, the heavenly messengers, what they call the Devadutas, are old age, sickness, death. Rather than seeing these as specters, depressing and unwanted specters, that come to us and scare us, we begin to look at them as messengers, or what in we translate as heavenly messengers, or a deva duta in Pali refers, deva always refers to something heavenly, and duta is messenger. Well, what does that mean in terms of our own experience, in terms of our own experience of life? What deva dutas have we encountered? And we all have, haven't we? We've all been have to experience loss, for one thing. We've all had, just like our parents, we've had to see them get old, get sick and die. We've seen ourselves now getting old. We have to experience pain and sickness and loss of loved ones. So this is common to all human beings. It's not There's nothing wrong with it. It's not bad, but it is pointing to this conditioned realm is something to contemplate and understand rather than to hold to and grasp to and make assumptions from and try to control it and bend it to one's desires and to one's will. Because the more we try to do this, the more disappointing it becomes, until we feel, you know, despair and fear and depression, and all these negative mental states tend to dominate our conscious experience. So it's when we begin to look at Devadutas, or just our own sicknesses or disabilities or pain, the aging process of the body, and the loss of loved ones, or loss of family, or even your cat or your dog or whatever. There's this whatever we love and we cherish, it's inevitably subject to death. And when something we love dies, then this is the feeling we have of grief. And in noticing this, like, then we are taking the First Noble Truth, and instead of just feeling frightened and negative and averse to it, we're willing to learn from it. So it's like understanding suffering. And to understand suffering, it's not trying, if we're trying to get rid of it and deny it and push it away, run away from it, then we can never really understand it. We can only, because the reactions are such that we're resisting any possibility of understanding it. So understanding then means a willingness to suffer. And it's not the kind of masochism that we're encouraging, but it's a kind of positive sense of trust in which we are willing to look at our own sense of despair or inadequacy or fear or loss, grief, in a way that we're not thinking about it but noticing. It's like this, and as we examine it more and by understanding it, by accepting it, by embracing it, we begin to see that all these mental states are also ceasing, that you can't sustain them. You can't. Even though you feel that you'll never get over the loss of your loved one, you can actually. At moments, you notice when you're awake that there is moments when you think of that person and you feel grief, and then when you don't think of them, what happens? You may not even notice that because you assume you have this continuous state of grief as your mental state. That if you're willing to trust in your own awareness of it, you see that this is something that is changing. That for example, grief is like this. So in accepting grief, we're not clinging to it anymore. We're not saying it's mine or making any value judgments about it at all. We're willing to feel grief, willing to understand it, willing to be with it, willing to let it be what it is. And then what happens is it ceases. And as you observe that, you observe the cessation of it, then you can begin to notice or mentally note the absence of grief is like this. In the Third Noble Truth, then the cessation or the absence of something, of a condition that existed that is no longer present. Now, how do we realize this? And so this is a reality and a realization. And this takes then this intuitive awareness, because when you're thinking about it too much, you forget. You can't really be with it. You get lost in your own kind of logic and reason and associations and sense of yourself. But if you're willing to totally accept something for what it is and allow it to be the way it is, then you're looking at it through wisdom and understanding rather than through some kind of personal distortion of it. As long as you feel grief is, I'm grieving and grief is mine, and how can I get over this grief and what should I do about it, and life will never be the same again, and then you're proliferating. So one of those thoughts will connect, and you'll just be caught in a kind of sense of perpetuating this feeling, and kind of projecting it outward on all your experience of life. So you see the things around you through this veil that you're attached to, this distortion that you hold to. So in the second noble truth, the insight is to let go of the causes of suffering, which is this attachment to the conditions, to the born. And this attachment is out of not understanding. The attachment is more like a habit that we have acquired, and that we don't even know we're doing it. We're certainly not intentional. We aren't, I'm going to hold on and to this grief no matter what. We're usually trying to get rid of it, trying to brush it aside or do anything to distract ourselves from it. But this very desire to get rid of it is an attachment out of ignorance, because you're not willing to learn from the heavenly messenger. You're merely trying to deny or resist it. So in letting go of suffering, when we let go of it, it's not a rejection out of fear, out of denial, out of ignorance, but it's an understanding that comes from the understanding of suffering. And letting go then is not throwing away or pushing away, but letting it be, in other words. So I'm not holding, but I'm letting this feeling, this emotion be in the present, be what it is. And that takes a certain sense of trust in your ability to bear it, to bear with the suffering, with the unpleasantness, with the pain, with the misfortunes, the failures, the disappointments of life. When we explore our conscious experience or look at it more closely, like noticing the space between Rojana and Catherine, it doesn't sound like anything very important, what's there to look at? Just space. But it's also a noting of the reality that when I look between them, then it's I can see it with my eyes. So it's not like I'm making up something. And therefore I begin to notice, it's like this, if I start observing space more, just on a visual level, the result is a sense of spaciousness. Because space doesn't have any quality to it except spaciousness. It's not, in the space there can be blue and red and men and women and chairs and tables, but then they have certain qualities and properties, but space itself, All you can say about, say, in terms of experience, is it's spacious. And so this is a way of training yourself to begin to notice that the way it is, in which you're letting go of just the habitual tendency of going from one to the other and just noticing the things and admiring the qualities or being appalled by the the unpleasantness of a condition. You're not at this moment. I'm not interested in analyzing or comparing or making anything about the conditions, but they can be what they are. But as I open to the space, then it allows the space contains us all. It's not just there, but it's everywhere. It permeates everything. So then we're beginning to get a little more aware, a little more insight into the unborn. Because it's here and now, but we don't know. It's like the space is an obvious one. We can actually visually contemplate space. Now just taking that word space, you know, not as something to grasp, but as a word that points to the reality that exists here. It means that I'm not particularly taking an interest in the conditions. So I don't have to ask you all to go and remove all the furniture. Then I'll say, then the room is in the way. Tear down the building. I don't need to. It's not a destruction or an annihilation of anything, but it's an awareness that begins to expand and give this sense of expansion and infinity that we may not be at all aware of. I remember, reading these enigmatic statements that eternity is now and before I ever meditated, if it's now. because everything that I'm in my mind associates with is time bound. Like myself, my personality, the sense of myself as a person is a condition, you know, that and the body is time bound condition, and the building. I ask, how old is this building? And so forth. I can follow the history and trace the, you know, try to understand this place in terms of when things were built, when the botanical garden first appeared, and its development, and so forth. Take an interest in that side of it. That's one. But that's taking an interest in the time-bound conditions, or in the plants, or the variety of species in flora and fauna that we have in this garden, which is, you know, certainly interesting and fascinating in itself. But if I remain only on that level, then something in me still is bound to those conditions and can't see through them or beyond them. So in exploring, conditioned phenomena as anicca, dukkha, anatta, or impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self, I do begin to lose, if I do it in the right way, rather than through just, you know, believing in these and projecting the ideas onto experience, if I start noticing how changing our experience is, and how we assume that somebody is the perception that we have in our mind. So I remember on a meditation retreat on Amaravati years ago, I asked everybody in the room, I said, where is your mother right now? Yes. Well, she's in Norfolk. and so getting people to question, you know, what is like the perception of my mother? And then recognizing that actually this is your mother is here in your mind, isn't it? Because you have a memory, you have a perception, you can even have an image, you can see your mother in your mind, but it's something that's here and now that you've created. It's a memory that comes and goes according to other conditions. And is that memory, is that perception really your mother? Or is it just what it is, a perception, a memory, a thought? an image. And then when you let it go, where's your mother? And, you know, right now I don't know. My mother, the perception of my mother is she's dead. And the Catholic priest said she's in heaven. But I don't know. And so this I know that I don't know. That is, that I don't need to know that. That I no longer need to hold to some view about my mother being up in heaven with the Lord as some way of making myself feel all right in this present moment. And it's not that I don't care, but I'm just willing to admit the limitations that I'm under in this particular form as a human being, this conscious experience of being a human entity. And so in the practice of meditation, we're beginning to awaken to, within the limitations of this human state we're in, with the way that we happen to be. For example, each one of us is a unique individual entity. So we can assume we're all human beings. We have a common bond of humanity that's present, and so we have common ground in many ways. But also the different habit patterns, different cultural identities, different ways of thinking, different emotional conditions that we're experiencing now that are beyond our ability to know. I can't know everything that's going on in everybody in this room at this moment. But I can know what's going on here, the kind of mental state or emotional condition that I can witness at this time. And as I open to that, as I allow this mental state to be conscious, rather than just reacting and controlling or ignoring it, then I begin to notice that it's that you can't sustain an emotional state. That it changes very quickly, and it also ceases if you don't feed it with thinking and judging and proliferating with it. But if you begin to just stop thinking and just observing, just noticing, trusting in your ability to just observe, be fully attentive, awake and conscious, then it's like this. So then in my own practice, I've taught many times, people are interested in my use of this sound of silence practice. And this I've explored over the years because I found it a very helpful way of reflecting on experience. Because when I am letting go of everything and just in a state of pure presence, pure being aware, I begin to recognize this kind of vibratory background. Is it a sound? Is it a vibration? You know, in terms of perception of how I would, it seems like a sound, because that's how I experience it. In terms of if I want to put a label on it or explain it in any way. But yet, unlike sound itself, it has a continuity. You know, it has like a vibratory quality, but it sustains itself, and it's the background of all other sounds. So right now, I can be fully present with this sound of silence. And I can still be talking and looking at you because it's an embracing background. It has a sense of infinity, has no boundary. It's like space or consciousness. consciousness in this sense. I'm fully conscious, and this consciousness has a continuity to it. That in other words, I'm not caught in just the manipulation of my thoughts and emotions and reacting and playing with the conditions that arise in consciousness, but beginning to acknowledge and recognize what pure subjectivity, or because it's cut in terms of this moment, it's a kind of absolute subjectivity, but it's non-personal. It has no, because the person, then if I start claiming it in terms of it's mine, then I'm creating a person that owns it. But if I don't do that, if I refuse to think or create it or make anything out of it, then it is what it is. It's like this. So noticing that, then I notice that other sounds arise and cease in it, and it also enhances sound itself. So in just like the sound of flowing water, water falling, or the sound of a stream, if you listen to the sound of a stream or a waterfall, behind that you can actually recognize the sound of silence. And I've noticed that as I tune into that and begin to rest in that more and more, then the sound of the stream is enhanced, or the water, the sound of falling water, so that it's like it rather than canceling out or obliterating, it seems to enhance and help and support all other sounds, all other or noises or whatever. You can hear it in the background of all music, or anything, wherever you are, or the sound of noisy machinery, the chainsaw or the lawnmower or whatever. So what is that, you know, in terms of wanting to claim it as some kind of attainment, then it gets back into some kind of sense of myself as somebody who has something or other. But there's no need for claiming, but for trusting in this ability we all have of attention to the present moment. Eternity is now. And so the Buddha's teaching then is one of, it's the teaching of awakeness. And the Buddha, actually the word means the awakened. And in the forest tradition, the mantra that we're given to use is the Bhutto, or this, the mantric form of Buddha. So in Ajahn Mun and these forest Ajahns used to call it the one who knows. But it's not like the one or the person, or that it's somebody that knows, but it is knowing, isn't it? It's not, there's nobody that knows anything, but it is the reality of knowing that is non-personal. It's an interesting time now where consciousness, that word, the English word, consciousness, is being examined more thoroughly. And we tend to limit consciousness like it is some kind of brain function, so that we tend to see it and define it in terms of maybe thinking or in terms of if we're unconscious, what does that mean? It means we aren't thinking, or we're not awake. We're not, you know, so that it means like consciousness no longer exists for us. And therefore, it in this particular form, it isn't operating. And that's how it seems. But when we begin to look at consciousness instead of in such a limited way as some kind of mental function of our brain, to me now it's more like that this is the experience of consciousness, whether I'm conscious or not, whether I'm aware. You know, there's awareness and consciousness, but consciousness is the natural state of our being. And these particular forms then operate, are ways of experiencing consciousness in which we have this subject-object experience. So, in terms of right now, then the subject is here and you're the objects. You see, so you're in consciousness, but you're not in my brain. You know, it's not like, something that I can claim as some kind of creation of my own on a personal level, but it's like this. I can see your face, but I can't see my own face. You can see my eyes, but I can't. I can see yours, but you can't see your own eyes. But then you see, and that's the important thing, isn't it? It's not a matter of, you don't need to see your own eyes, because seeing is the point. Or, knowing things as they are is the point, rather than trying to find who is it that knows all this. You know, that's another question. What is it that knows? Who is it that knows? What is behind all this? And we want to, we're like, is it God, or is it ultimate truth? Or we want a name in for it in some way, because that level of our of conditioning very much wants to define things, wants to hold things in forms, in perceptions, and if we don't have those forms and perceptions used, then we tend to dismiss or ignore, or reject, or even feel frightened by this experience of the unborn. This being awake, then, when the Buddha gave his teaching and saying of the Four Noble Truths, in order to appreciate the First Noble Truth, you have to awaken to suffering. Now, we might know, oh, I'm suffering, and because I didn't get what I wanted, and so forth, and I can be, you know, I think I'm aware that I'm suffering, but I'm taking it always on a very highly, I see it in, through personal interpretation. Or I blame it on others. I see it, somebody's making me suffer, or the world, or I can get angry with God, you know, for creating me and making me suffer like this. Or I can just blame myself as a person, you know, that it's my fault that I suffer. But this suffering then isn't something to interpret in that way, but to awaken to it. It's like this. And so in this reflection on it's like this, you're, what are you doing? You're beginning to accept and allow something that before maybe you only resisted and rejected and ran away from. Well, then that means that you're actually, once you begin to appreciate this, you actually then can trust that awakened awareness, something to develop and cultivate in life, an attention, an awakened, intuitive sense of the present. It's like this, and whatever, how we want to experience, to, you know, whatever way we're feeling, we can observe it physically, just by being aware of your own body at this moment, because our bodies are like this, my body's like this, sitting down is like this, breathing is like this, with the feeling hot or cold is like this, mental state, mood or emotional state is like this, the sound of silence is like this. These are all here and now, and they're all embraced within this vast, open acceptance, awakened acceptance of this moment. And so the eternity is now doesn't mean that any of these conditions are eternal. They arise and cease, and you quickly notice that. But that awakened state, if you trust it, and cultivate it, then that lasts beyond the length and of the conditions that you're experiencing. And so this is why I advise you and encourage you to trust it. Now, people do tend to see themselves in meditation in terms of attainments or lack of attainments. So one of the common questions is, I've been practicing 20 years and I don't think I've gotten anywhere. I don't think I've attained anything. And because the basic delusion has never been really penetrated, that this is a created thought in the present. I've not achieved anything yet. So the being aware of that, isn't it? You begin to no longer believe these kind of statements that your mind produces and the beliefs about yourself and that as reality. You're beginning to have this sense of the infinite or the unborn, unconditioned, the deathless, in which you can no longer limit yourself, bind yourself to the death-bound conditioning that you have. You begin to, the liberation is through letting go, through allowing life to flow, through openness, through attention, rather than through control, running away, and through just limited to the perceptions you have and of your personality or your physical condition. So I'll end here, and we have about 10 minutes now for questions. I just say the same thing over and over again. Because we're finding, like now in, say, at Amaravati, we get a lot of Christians coming, Christian monastics especially, like Roman Catholic or Anglican. And there's a lot of interest in Buddhist meditation coming from especially from Roman Catholicism. And so it's because you realize within Christianity now there are those that are exploring beyond just the conventional approach that they have. And this really I find, I want to encourage, because it's you realize that that this is something, what a religion really does is to me, when they say Buddhism is not a religion, to me it is. It's a religion is a convention, in itself. So it's limited because it's not ultimate reality, but it's pointing at the ultimate reality. Or God, or the unborn, whatever, these are words that you use to convey that sense that is beyond definition, that is unborn, but the reality. And so, this is, to me, rather interesting, to see that, Christians now beginning to realize this, having the courage and the kind of incentive and the sense of freedom of exploration to where they can begin to get beyond just the definitions and that they're given through the convention. Now, to me, it doesn't make any difference what word you want to use to put that. It's merely a convention itself, like the word God or the unborn it doesn't matter in terms of that there's one word that's right and the rest is wrong. And their function is encouraging an awakened attention to the present in which you realize, you recognize the unborn rather than, and that unborn then isn't something you can define. It's something you open to and let go of your desire to define it, to contain it, to hold it in some way. Because that's all coming out of your desires and your fears and the conditioning of your mind. You know, so that habit, that tendency to, I've got to know, and is this it or not? But one thing you can trust is in this moment, even if you desire to know, be aware of this desire to know. And be willing to not know, allowing confusion or ignorance or doubt or whatever to be what it is in the present. So that you're not caught in this endless kind of fumbling around and doubting state that we create when we don't allow ourselves to be fully present and awake with the conditions and the reality of this moment. So one of the practices is not knowing. Or Ajahn Chah's taught this mainan. Mainan means nothing certain, don't know. And this was his main teaching was don't know, rather than trying to know everything. Now, when you allow yourself not to know, you know not knowing. So it's not like a stupid not knowing, is it? It's a wisdom of knowing that you don't know. And then you can trust in that, in this wisdom, because this is our inheritance. This is our humanity. You know, the thing that the value of our being human is that we have a way of understanding and of knowing and of freeing ourselves from the limitations that we bind ourselves to through ignorance. So I remember developing not knowing, and after I got over the initial kind of and just learn to accept, I began to find it so peaceful not to know. And then like people ask me all kinds of questions about things that I don't know. What happens when you die? Don't know. I haven't died. Is there an afterlife? Is there a rebirth, a reincarnation? Don't know. From this position, you know, I can give you the kind of textual references around these stuff. But in terms of direct knowing, now I don't know because this is the present. This is the reality, and I can speculate about what happens when somebody dies. But that's speculating, isn't it? It's not knowing. It's holding to some maybe preferred view about it.